Life Management Science Labs would like to acknowledge that we live and produce this podcast on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. We'd also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of our listeners and our international colleagues. We'd like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Hello, everyone, and welcome to CeraBoost, the Happiness Science Insights podcast produced by LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. We're champions of life management science, providing structured insights informed by science and inspired by practice on key aspects of conscious living. Each week, we bring you scientific and practical insights on each element with the expert knowledge of professionals in the field. I'm your host, Lu Ngo, coming to your ears from NARM, Melbourne, Australia. Let's learn together. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to CeraBoost. And we're here to talk about happiness again. On this week's episode, we are going to talk about the psychological impact of guilt. I think it's safe to say that guilt is a big factor that affects our happiness. But I think from a psychological perspective, today we can all learn more from our guest of the day, Andrea Matthews. And I would like to introduce her, and then I'll ask her to also share a bit more about herself. Andrea is a licensed professional counselor in the US and an author and trainer for other counselors. She has over 30 years' experience in the mental health field and has written 4 books. She has a blog on Psychology Today entitled Traversing the Inner Terrain with over 4 million readers. She also hosts a podcast entitled Authentic Living, interviewing some of the world's most influential authors and teachers. Thanks so much for joining us today, Andrea. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, so glad to have you here. And I think your bio is super impressive. And that got me really curious. You know, I would love to learn more about you, especially, you know, how you got here in your career and why you decided to do the work that you're doing. And you've written 4 books. You know, what are they about?
Well, the first book is no longer in print, so I should say that. And the reason it isn't is because I took it off the market because it had some outdated information in it. But the book was about, it's called Restoring My Soul, and it is about how to find and live the authentic self. So that was the first book, and that one was self-published. And then I published a book about the law of attraction because I had heard so many people say things like, well, I'm practicing the law of attraction, and I want to have my $1 million, and I haven't gotten it yet. And so I, was very concerned about people thinking they could never have a so-called negative thought and that they could, they had only positive thoughts and that they only could do that in order to attract what they wanted. And if they got something that was not what they wanted, they blamed themselves, speaking of guilt, and they didn't, you know, do well because of that. So I wrote a book about that. About the law of attraction. And then the third book is called Inhabiting Heaven Now. And it is about, it's a more spiritual book. And it's about how we think that, you know, planet Earth is just the life we live, but there's a whole idea of duality. And there's an idea of oneness in which we are one with the divine, however we see the divine. And another idea that we are down here on earth struggling on our own, and the divine is way up there and we can't get to it. And so I worked on that in that book, hopefully dispelled some of the myths about that. And my latest book I'll just show you a copy of that, called Letting Go of Good. And it's called Dispel the Myth of Goodness to Find Your Genuine Self. And it has a lot about guilt in it. And it's about an identity, which I call the good guy identity, which I've called in other books the scapegoat identity. And we can certainly talk about that more as we go through the session today. But those are the 4 books.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing the 4 books, and definitely we'll dive deeper into the latest book because it's related to today's topic. But as I asked before, and I know I asked a lot of questions, I want to circle back to that question. You know, your career seems fascinating, you know, with all the different, sort of topics that you have talked about. So how did you get here, and why did you choose to talk about these topics?
Well, of course, anybody's career is a long story, so we could go on and on about that, but I'll try to keep it brief. Yeah, I started off in the field of social work, working first with disabled persons, and then later with people with a drug addiction, and then later with people with that had abuse their children, and so trying to work with them to teach them better parenting skills and that kind of thing. And then ultimately, I got my license and worked in the mental health field, working in various positions, counselor, family therapist. I moved up to program director, and then I moved up to clinical director, and then I was clinical consultant, all this over many years, of course. And then I decided I was tired of working for other people, so I wanted to start my own practice. And so I did that, and it was successful, and I would say surprisingly successful, because you never know when you start off in business for yourself whether it's going to work or not, but it did. And I've had a good practice for over 25 years now. So, so I love working with clients. I'm now what we call semi-retired, in that I spend 4 hours a day writing and 4 hours a day working with clients. So that is a very enjoyable career for me.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you for sharing your story. And it is true. It's hard to talk about such a long career in a few sentences. But, you know, hopefully our audience got to know you a bit better there. And to get to know you even better, we have a section called Have You Met Andrea? And now I'm going to get you to share some of your recommendations or some of your favorite things. And that would allow us to get to know you even better. Now, first question, I know you're a book author, but I wonder which book would you actually recommend to our audience?
Wow, that's a tough question. I mean, it depends on the audience, I guess. It depends on what you're looking for, whether you're looking for more of a mental health approach or more of a spiritual approach. But lately, of course, I would recommend the latest book, Letting Go of Good, because really what it's about is we want to stop trying to be good and start trying to be real. And I just think that's sort of a calling that we all have today, to try to be more authentic. And a lot of people don't really know what it means to be authentic, but that this book addresses that. So I think that might be the one I'd recommend.
Yeah, that's a really important thing that we all need to learn. You know, being authentic is definitely not easy at all, because we have so many streams of influence and, you know, different things that happen in our lives, which we'll talk about in a bit, especially in the context of guilt. Now, on a lighter note and, you know, sort of more fun for some of the audience, which movie would you recommend?
Huh. All of them? No, I have so many that I really love. I'm trying to think of one that I've seen lately that was really moving. And I can't think of it. I'm not really good about remembering the names of movies and actors and things like that. There's one on TV right now called Pretty Woman that's being recorded right this minute. But yeah, I'm having a hard time coming up with an actual movie that I can recommend. I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful with that.
That's okay. Is Pretty Woman a movie? Was that what you were talking about?
Yeah, it's a movie with Richard Gere, and you know, it's about really, it's about a prostitute who starts trying to find her own authenticity.
Okay, yeah. That's a good recommendation there, right there. You know, even though it's hard, you came to something. Good to know.
Yeah, it's an old movie, but.
Yeah, cool. So I know that you have a podcast that you host yourself. Now, I'm not going to be surprised if you recommend that podcast, but still going to ask the question, which podcast would you recommend to your audience?
Oh, you know, I can't remember the name of Oprah's podcast, but definitely I would recommend Oprah's podcast. I mean, you just could put in Oprah into Google and come up with her podcast. It's called Super Soul. That's the name of it. Super Soul. And she interviews some great people. And I think she's, you know, really one of the most influential people on the planet. And so, yes, definitely. Of course, I would recommend mine as well. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for that. I love Oprah as well. Now, this is going to probably be related to the next question. Who is your role model? I know we put famous in the original question, but this could be somebody you know personally, or some of our guests even say, I have multiple role models.
I do. I have multiple role models. Again, Oprah would be one of those. But also Caroline Mace, I don't know whether you're familiar with her or not. She's written several books and does a lot of work online and teaches courses. And also Thomas More. He had a best-selling, and Caroline Mace has also had some best-selling books as well. And Thomas More, Care of the Soul, came out in the late 90s, was also a best-selling book, and he's written 30-odd books since then. And I'd love to be just like either one of those.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing. Final question in this part is about a course you've completed. I would love to know which course you've completed that left a really strong impact on you.
You mean courses in college or courses in...
In general.
In general. Well, I love human growth and development courses about that. I love to talk about where people came from and what are they thinking and how they got to that thought and how they got to that particular identity and anything that works on that particular issue would be a course that I would love.
Okay. Any course recently with that topic that you've taken?
I have been to many workshops, and I cannot think of any particular thing in terms of that right now. I can't think of the names of any of them. But yes, most of the workshops I go to have something to do with that. Carl Jung is one of the people I follow, and I'm on the board of Friends of Jung South in the southern part of the United States. And we put on a lot of workshops. Thomas More was just there. Not long ago to talk about his own working with the soul, helping people work with the soul. I think he's got a recent book out too called The Eloquence of Silence. And he talked about that in that workshop as well. So anything having to do with Carl Jung, I'm there for it.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing. That sounds great. Now let's talk about today's topic. And, you know, I've been waiting to talk about this because I think we are all holding or carrying some sort of guilt in our lives. And I think this is really important to talk about, especially because, you know, from a psychological perspective, I guess everyday people wouldn't think about it as much. You know, we all know what guilt feels like or when it appears. But I guess today we probably will put it in context even more. Before we get into that part, this show is about happiness. So let's talk about happiness to set the scene for the conversation, because we know that guilt definitely affects our happiness, but we need to understand how. So first of all, what does happiness mean to you personally?
Well, the first thing I want to say about happiness is that it's an inside job. We don't get happiness by having things or having relationships or excelling in the world or great achievements or being famous or being a celebrity. There's certainly a lot of famous and people who are celebrities who are not happy people. And we've seen that historically over and over again. But people who do the work of finding a deeper part of themselves and living from that, which I would call the authentic self, or synonymous with those words, authentic self is the word soul. Also the word spirit. I mean, those are all interchangeable words as I think of them. And so if we're living from that deeper aspect of ourselves, then not only would I call that happiness, but I would call it joy. And I think joy is a clinical term. That's not very well known and probably very well used, but I do think that when people have joy, they usually don't have depression. They usually don't have anxiety. What we want to do is look for a career or a job, however you want to think about, that has a lot of tasks that you really enjoy doing, instead of doing tasks that you really hate doing. You know, I've seen people go to a job that might give them lots of money and lots of prestige and lots of power, but they don't really like the tasks of the job, the everyday, mundane, routine tasks of the job. They don't like that. And so they're not very happy people. They might have a lot of money. They might have a lot of power. They might have a lot of prestige, but they're not very happy. And so if we look for jobs that we really love the tasks of that job, the everyday, mundane tasks of that job, we're liable to be happier. If we seek out relationships with people who, with whom we have something in common, and I'm talking about friendships as well as romantic relationships, we need something in common with them. We need to share the same values with them. If they have very divergent values from us, then we're probably not going to understand each other, and we may be critical of each other, which does not add up to happiness. So we need to seek out people we feel at home with and can be authentic with, and that leads to happiness as well. So really, what I'm saying is, if we look to the inner self and follow that, we're more likely to have happiness than if we just seek it outside of ourselves.
Yeah, I really love that definition and the way that you look at happiness, especially because when you talk about, you know, our job, our career. The other day we had a conversation, also a podcast, not on happiness, but on well-being. And one of the guests was talking about how we spend, I think, if I remember correctly, 80,000 to 90,000 hours in our lives, or yeah, or something of that sort, working. And that number is, you know, is pretty impressive. And when you think about how much time we spend working, it has to spark joy, and it has to be something we actually enjoy for it to bring or to add to our happiness, you know. And I just love that you said it's an inside job. And I guess you actually debunked a few things there, because the next question was supposed to be about misconceptions about happiness. And I guess you already addressed some of them through your answers. First of all, it doesn't come from outer sources, I guess. If we were to sort of look at the, you know, opposite, it comes from within. We need to work on it actively. And obviously the environment and things around it, I think they do impact our levels of happiness to a certain extent, but it is what we choose to do with what we have and with the circumstance that really matter. And you know, like the spending a lot of time at work there, when you talk about power and money, I guess a lot of people think, you know, the more power and the more money I have, the happier I'd be. And in fact, sometimes that is complete opposite, because they're not enjoying what they're doing. So it's not about the power of the money, is actually about the work. And so two misconceptions there that you already addressed. Now, on top of those two, would you like to address anything else that people might get wrong when it comes to happiness?
Yeah, I think it's also true that people are looking for a state of bliss, you know, perpetual bliss. And when I talk about happiness, I'm not talking about bliss. I mean, yes, there are states of bliss that we get into, and certainly we look forward to those and we want those, you know, at least some frequency in our lives, but we can't live out of bliss. It's just not going to happen. So when we set ourselves up to say, I have to be in bliss all the time, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. So when I talk about happiness, I'm talking about a core inner level of contentment that says, I like my life. You know, we hear people say, I hate my life. Well, we need to like our lives. And if we enjoy our lives, then we're pretty happy, usually. And the life is something we create. It's not something that happens to us. And that would be another misconception, is that, you know, a happy life is just going to drop into our lap some kind of lucky way, right? We're going to win the lottery, or we're going to, you know, get this great job that we really love and want to be in, and it's going to happen to us. Well, we have to create our own happiness. It's not something that happens to us most of the time. I guess every now and then something drops in our laps, and that's a great blessing. But most of the time we have to seek it. And if we're seeking it outside of ourselves, like we said a little while ago, we're not likely to find it. But if we're seeking it inside of ourselves by making choices that lead from in here to out there instead of out there to in here, then we're more likely to find happiness. So a core level of contentment is what we're talking about. And then periods of joy, periods of bliss, yes, but not this constant state of bliss.
Yeah, so I totally agree with what you were sharing there, you know, when people get things that people get wrong about happiness, especially the bliss, you know, the constant seek, perpetual bliss that you were talking about, that's just so relatable. And it has been addressed a few times on the show, but I think it's still important to, you know, emphasize it to our audience, because a lot of the times we have this culture of, you know, everything needs to be great. Everything needs to be perfect. You have to be happy all the time. You have to be blissful all the time, whichever word that people might resonate with, or joyful. And I believe that, you know, it's impossible to achieve that state when we don't feel the lows in life. And in fact, I saw this quote the other day that is really great. And it's like such a great, like it's such a heartwarming thing to read. I don't remember the exact wording, and I don't remember who wrote it, but I think it's somewhere on Twitter, and or it's called X now, I think. And it kind of goes, when you're going through a period in life where it feels stagnant, or you know nothing is happening, it's actually the like something along the line of the universe making space for you to heal from things that you cannot take with you to the next chapter when things are going to happen again. And when I think about that, I was like, whoa, that's so great, you know, because we always want things to be happening all the time. We all sort of like seek for, you know, great things to happen, for things to change, or for something to be happening in our lives. And that was actually me, you know, like I think it's so relatable. And actually on today's topic, there's even that guilt of why is nothing happening and why am I not able to drag myself out of whatever I'm feeling right now to make things happen, to make things moving, especially when, you know, for high achievers, you know, I consider myself a high achiever. And sometimes, you know, when you achieve a lot in a short period of time and then there's a pause, you're kind of like, oh, I feel guilty now because I need to be achieving more, you know. And I think I don't know if this is related to what you are writing in your book, but you know, in your latest book, which I'm just going to say the title again for our audience, it's called Letting Go of Good, Dispel the Myth of Goodness to Find Your Genuine Self. You mentioned this good guy identity. Now, I'm not sure what this means. I haven't been able to get the chance to read your book yet. So I would love for you to share more about this good guy identity. You know, does it mean that we're always doing good for others and ourselves? You know, what does it entail? And how does it relate to guilt, especially when it comes to our happiness?
Yeah, first I need to talk a little bit about identity. And as you said a few minutes ago, we can't stay in a state of happiness all the time. There are difficult feelings that we need to feel, and we'll be talking about that a little bit as we go. But identity itself is something that is not authentic. It's a mask and costume. Now, I want to sort of separate that a little bit from someone who says, I'm identified as gay, I'm identified as non-binary, or something like that. Those identities are authentic. This is a person coming into their authentic self. When I refer to identity as a part of the construct of the good guy identity, I'm referring to a mask and costume that's not authentic. So I want to make that really clear. So the term is kind of mixed. But identity starts, as I'm using it, identity starts when we're little. We grow up in families who, regarding their dysfunction, and that dysfunction is on a scale. It's you know, you can't say it's either terribly dysfunctional or great functional. It you know, runs a spectrum. So depending on that spectrum and where you are, or that family is on that spectrum, the person will develop an identity that meets the needs of that family. So if mom, for example, just is somebody who can't admit to being wrong, well, where's that wrong going to go? It goes to the child. The mother projects that wrongness onto the child, and the child feels bad, feels like a bad person, feels like a wrong person, and they just adopt that as their identity. And they may go one or two ways. They could act out as the bad person, right, and do all kinds of things that might not be accepted by society or even break the law, and they might become worse and worse so that they can prove that they're still alive, because this identity is associated with being alive. I live as my identity, right? So then they could also take the other route and become what I call the good guy identity. And that's someone who feels unworthy inside, and so tries to compensate for that feeling of unworthiness by living out a good guy identity. So I'm going to do a lot of really good things. I'm going to sacrifice myself for others. I'm going to play the caretaker every chance I get. I'm going to just build all my relationships around being good and serving them and taking good care of them. I'm not going to ask for much for myself. And of course, we know that that can also lead to some very dysfunctional relationships where that person with a good guy identity could end up being abused physically, if not, emotionally, if not physically. So then, you know, we have to work on, okay, how did that happen? Well, very often it happened because, and I'm not saying every case of abuse is like this. There's many different ways people can be abused. But in this particular scenario, the person might be being abused because they're not paying attention to what the other person's doing. They're paying attention to, I've got to be good, I've got to be good, I've got to be good. And so they're living in that way of thinking instead of noticing what the other person is doing. So if you want to talk a little bit about how the person might get out of that identity, I can do that
definitely.
As well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we'll touch on that very soon. But I guess what you mentioned there might be sort of hard for some of our audience to unpack, especially when we talk about our childhood, right? Those are formative years, but at the same time, sometimes they can be hard to recall. And I know that a lot of this work happens in the therapy room where they actually go through, you know, events and then find out exactly what happened in the past. And, you know, it's a process, you know, it's going to be a lot of work, you know, on all of us individually to actually be able to identify whether we have guilt that was carried from when we were a child or, you know, if this is something that we recently accumulated or a combination of both. You know, either way, it has an impact on our happiness. And you briefly mentioned that. So from this psychological perspective, how do you think, you know, I'm not sure if I'm using the correct word here, but trying to be the good guy can actually affect our happiness?
Well, absolutely. What I'm not paying attention to when I'm living out the good guy identity is how I feel. I'm not noticing what's going on in my life. I'm not noticing whether or not I enjoy my job. I'm not noticing whether or not this relationship is really a happy one. I'm noticing that I need to be good. I need to be good. So you mentioned working on childhood and whether or not a person might remember that. I want to go back to that so we can make sure that your audience can unpack that. You don't have to remember your childhood to do this work. You can just look at your life now and see what you're doing now and see how your relationships are working now and find the good guy identity there. So I'm doing all this stuff to sacrifice myself to others, and I wonder why none of my friends want to do anything for me. Well, it's because I've set that relationship up to be doing for them, and they've noticed that, and they've said, well, she's going to do for me, so I don't have to do for her. And that's not conscious. It's not something people do deliberately. But it happens. The relationships gets more and more unbalanced as one person is doing all the work. So back to the question that you asked, you know, a person who is living out the good guy identity is not happy in that they may feel good about having accomplished a service to somebody else. And I've heard many people who have a good guy identity say, well, I feel good after I've done that. And so I ask them, what do you mean good? Tell me what good means. And they will say, well, I feel like a good person. I feel like, you know, I've done good for other people. That means I'm a good person. And I ask them, does good mean happy? Well, not necessarily happy, but, you know, good. I feel like a good person. And so they haven't really noticed that they're not happy until they get to a wall. You know, they hit the wall and they can't do it anymore. Maybe they've been terribly abused. And they come into therapy for that reason. Maybe they have developed high blood pressure and their doctors referred them to therapy, or some other stress related disease. Or maybe they have just gotten tired, you know, really exhausted from having to serve other people. And maybe, and I see this a lot, they've built this resentment. You know, I'm so busy taking care of other people that I haven't noticed that I'm building resentment that nobody's ever taken care of me. And so they come to therapy and they ask me, you have to help me get rid of that resentment. And what I say, and what the book actually says as well, is resentment is your friend. Resentment is trying to tell you, in this case, not always, but in this case, is trying to tell you that you're doing a whole lot of stuff that you don't really want to do.
That hits really hard. I think, you know, for a lot of us, it's hard to tell these voices apart, you know, in a way, because you briefly touched on that. And I think this is what you mentioned in one of your articles on Psychology Today, I believe, where, you know, you talk about, you know, the voices of guilt and the voices of the authentic self. Sometimes we actually don't know why we're doing what we're doing and which voice is leading that behavior, and whether it's affecting us and causing resentment. I like that you said resentment can sort of be like, you know, a guide for us. You know, look at it and see what it's trying to tell us. But before we get to that resentment part, there are these voices that you mentioned, right? The voices of guilt and the authentic self. So this sounds really sort of theoretical for our audience, and even for myself at the moment, I'm trying to conceptualize how they work in reality. So how would you say we can start to identify the differences between these voices and know when we're listening to which voice?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. That's where the sort of rubber hits the road, isn't it? We can tell the difference between authentic voice and a guilty voice, because the authentic voice is going to tell us what we desire, and we'll come back to that in just a second. And the guilty voice is going to tell us what we should do or what we shouldn't do. So we get caught up so often in what's the right thing to do. And first of all, right and wrong are such nebulous concepts. So what's right to me may be wrong to you. What's right to one culture may be wrong to another culture. So right and wrong are up for grabs, right? And I'm not trying to say just go out and, you know, do all kinds of wrong things, you know, break the law and all that. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that we can live more by desire and less by shoulds. So my clients will often ask me, well, what should I do, Andrea? And I'll say, I don't have any shoulds for you. What do you want to do? And so asking yourself what you want to do is going to get you a more authentic answer than asking yourself what you should do. Because everybody's got a should for you. If you ask 15 different people what you should do, you're probably going to get 15 different answers. Or you might get several of the same answers, but they're very firm in this is what you should do, right? And, but that can't necessarily be validated by how it feels for you to do those shoulds. So when we live from desire, you know, now I'm not talking about living from compulsion. A lot of people get that mixed up with desire. So, you know, if you're an alcoholic and you say, I want another beer, right, that's not desire, that's compulsion. That's I really have to have another beer because I'm compelled to drink because I'm an alcoholic, right? But, or, you know, if I say I really want to be the CEO of the next company, but I haven't asked myself whether or not I like doing that job, then that's, you know, compensation or ego aggrandizement or something else besides desire, right? So we don't want to get it mixed up with those kind of things, but we do want to say desire is very important. And our world, not just the American society, but our world has built a lot of our lives on what we should do. You know, I once had a professor when I went to college. I once had a professor who said that I should go into chemistry. Now, I will tell you, I passed chemistry in high school by the skin of my teeth. I had a really hard time with chemistry. I hated it. And I did not want to go into chemistry, but I had passed this little test that said, that it was like this little exam that asked what was the formula for water. And I knew H2O was the formula for water. And so that meant I was good at chemistry, I guess. But of course, I turned her down and turned her down and turned her down. And I'm really glad I did, because I wanted to do the career that I wanted to do, not the career that she thought I should do. So that's what I'm talking about, is listening to that. I often give my clients a homework assignment to go home and spend 2 or 3 hours doing nothing but what they want to do. And you would be surprised how hard that is for some people, that they just can't even think about what they want to do. They have spent so many years doing what they should do that it's really hard for them to find what they want to do. So I get them to practice that and practice that and practice that and practice that, so that they can eventually say, well, this mm-hmm. is what I want to do. I'm going to go for a walk, something really simple like that. Or I'm going to listen to this music, or I'm going to go to work because I really want to go to work, whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because you not just mentioned the difference between the two voices, but you also mentioned the caveat that sometimes we can try and take it in the wrong way, where we say, I'm just going to go with my compulsion. It's not that at all. It's actually, what I want to do in alignment with my own authentic self that is good for me, not because other people tell me to, or not because, I think that I need to serve others in some shape or form. Because sometimes, and I think a lot of recovering people pleasers will resonate with this, I need to do this so that people would like me or spend more time with me. And I truly believe that it definitely goes back to our childhood. So there's a lot happening in that space. And I think it takes, each of us a lot of work to be able to understand our own way of thinking and which voices we're listening to on a daily basis. It truly is internal work. This is not a formula. There's no one-size-fits-all sort of way for us to know. So I think asking ourselves that question, like you were saying, is really important. But I think for a lot of people, they might go, well, that sounds fascinating. Maybe by doing so, I might be able to live a guilt-free life. And I think that is the trickiest part. And for me personally, I'm on the fence about this, because I don't think there will be such a thing as a guilt-free life. Like, I think sometimes guilt is good in the sense that if we truly did something wrong, and that guides us to be better people, better humans, that's important. But not in the sense that, our conditioning made us feel guilty for not doing something that is not in alignment with our authentic self. So there's a there's a difference there. And I think it's important to distinguish between the two, because guilt is such a broad concept. And we're just talking about, guilt for our authentic selves versus what we're thinking we're doing for the good of others. The good guy behavior, our identity, as you mentioned, that's very different from letting guilt guide us to be better humans. So I think the key here, and correct me if I'm wrong, is just to reduce the guilt that shouldn't be there. And to kind of, like you were saying at the very beginning, when you were saying, I can share some insights onto how people can, recover from it, or, just tone it down in our lives. So, yeah, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, just generally speaking, and I'll speak more specifically, but generally speaking, we don't want guilt to run our lives. We need to be able to discern when we're feeling guilty because of some should, and discern when we're feeling desire. And so I'll say that for a minute as well. But you're right. There is I've really done something to harm someone else. And that, I would change that term from guilt to remorse, just because, to make some kind of division between the two. Remorse means that I really feel bad about something that I've done that harms someone else. And I use harming someone else because I just said a little while ago that wrong and right are nebulous concepts, right? So if I get all caught up in what's wrong, then I might be telling myself it's selfish to think about myself, or it's selfish to even have one single thought about myself. It's selfish to consider self-soothing activities. It's selfish to have a career that I want when other people don't, or you know, enjoy my life when other people can't. That's, you know, we have a lot of that kind of thinking that goes with the good guy identity too. And so we might get caught up in what's wrong based on the shoulds. But I use the term harming someone else because those are things that really do matter in terms of what's wrong, so-called wrong and right. If I harm someone else, then that would be something that I might want to change that behavior in the future. I might want to make amends to that person, and I might want to change that behavior in the future. But guilt is so often not a remorse. Guilt is so often a feeling that I should have done differently or I should do differently, and it's all based on those shoulds. And ideas are misperceptions about reality. I call should the S word because it's one of those words that just has so much power over us. I mean, we have basically made saints out of people that we called selfless. And what I say is these are, now I'm not saying these people that are so-called saints are not really wonderful people. They truly are. But I am saying that the word selfless implies a person with no self. That's selfless, right? So we want to have a self. We want to own a self. We want to love that self. We want to have empathy for that self. We want to take care of that self. And if we're not doing that, then how can we be there for other people? If there's no self there, how can the self be there for other people? But what people that have a good guy identity are trying to do is without a self, they're trying to serve other people. And it becomes empty and frustrating and they feel kind of lost. I mean, I've had people come into my office and say, I don't know who I am anymore because they have just lost a sense of self entirely. So that would be...
Yeah, I think that's such an important point to raise because you're so right in saying that, you know, a lot of people are praised for being selfless. And then, yes, there's truly no sense of self there. And I think a lot of that is related to setting boundaries, you know, understanding what we like and don't like. And I think for me personally, it's a learning process. You know, sometimes I find it hard to say no. I find it hard to, you know, set boundaries. And, you know, that is the voice of guilt guiding me, not the voice of my authentic self. And I adore people that can just go and say no and just, you know, establish what they want to do and what they don't want to do. And, you know, in the past, it was actually quite uncomfortable to kind of see that because I couldn't see why they were doing that. And sometimes it can come across as something that is just so unreasonable. Why wouldn't you do that? It's such a small thing. You know, it's just a hangout, just a coffee. Why wouldn't you do that with you know, me or somebody else? Or why wouldn't they respond to messages? And I think these are just small examples that anyone can relate to nowadays. You know, this happens a lot. But then, you know, as I go through this learning process and understanding the authentic self a bit more, and especially through today's conversation, it makes sense. It makes perfect sense. Those people are just not driven by guilt whatsoever. They are driven by their authentic self and what they truly want to do.
Yes, and speaking of boundaries, we, you know, if the, like you said, the authentic self knows what's real for that person and what's not. And that's the way I want to say that. It's not just because I want it. It's also because that's the most real thing I can do right now. And so, you know, when people talk about holding to their boundaries, what they're really saying is, I have a self and I want to honor that. And but, you know, when I am living in the good guy identity, I'm afraid, like you said a little while ago, that people won't like me. I'm afraid that I'm going to turn people away and I won't have any friends. I'm afraid I won't be a good person and I'll feel just really like a terrible person. I'm afraid of all kinds of things like that. And then we have to say that fear as well as guilt is running my life because I'm afraid of all those things. So boundaries are really, really important so that I can define me. I mean, if you think about it, the reason I have a skeleton is because that gives me a structure for my body, right? If I didn't have a skeleton, I'd just be jello. And there would be no firm set boundary for me. But if I have those bones in there, then I know where I stop and you begin. My body knows that. What we need to do is do that psychologically as well, that I know where I stop and you begin. You're allowed to have your boundaries and I'm allowed to have mine. And that works really well in a relationship. What we so often think is we get in a relationship, and particularly a romantic relationship, and we're supposed to be one, right? And what that we think that means is that I'm supposed to give up what I want and you're supposed to give up what you want, and then we'll just be one, right? And so neither person knows what they want and neither person knows what the other person wants because nobody's communicating. And that's not intimacy. Intimacy is I know you really, 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 really well. And you know me really, 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 really well. And so therefore, I've said to you what I want and I've said to you what's real for me and vice versa. And therefore, we have a real relationship.
I really love that. I mean, this conversation has been quite broadly, you know, in general for people and, you know, relationships in general. But I think romantic relationships are such big ones in our lives because, you know, you spend so much time with your partner. And I actually like what you're saying because I really don't like it when people call their partner their other half. And this is just a personal thing based on observation. But what you were saying is kind of resonating because I think it's kind of like, are you not whole? You know, you're a whole person, right? You're not half a person. So there's no need to find your other half per se. And I think maybe that's driven by guilt. It's a societal thing that has happened for so long that, you know, we need someone to complete us, perhaps. And I think I think about this concept a lot, and I think it's fascinating to see. And when you mentioned that in the context of setting boundaries, that's perfect. Because that's true. We need to know ourselves, know our authentic self and our partner's authentic self as well. So we can add to each other's lives. Not that we need to be one and, you know, everything needs to be with just that one person. I don't think that is the true, you know, meaning of romantic relationships in a way. And there's so much more to it. We have a whole show on romantic relationships at LMSL. So, you know, if the audience is interested, they can check that out. But yeah, I think from what I've learned in that show, as well as, you know, personal experience and what you were saying, I just love that because yeah, we're whole and we need to know our authentic self. You know, there's no need to find, you know, our better half or our other half. I think it's just a matter of finding a person that can understand our authentic self, just like what you're saying. And we honor their authentic self as they honor ours.
Yeah, I don't know whether you have that in Australia, but there's a movie in America called Jerry Maguire. I don't know whether you've have ever heard of that, but there's a line in there where the lead character says to his girlfriend, "You complete me." And you know, it's like this, everybody loves that line. Everybody repeats that line. And it's just such a wonderful line and such a romantic line. And, you know, every time I hear it, I'm like, no, I don't think so. I don't think, you know, that somebody else can complete you. I think you complete yourself and you enjoy the company and the intimacy that you can have with somebody else.
Yeah, that is so true. Otherwise, we'll lose our authentic self. Or lose sight of our authentic self, I think, just on today's topic, because we feel like we need to be, you know, devote ourselves to that relationship right, to gain an intimacy. And that is the voice of guilt guiding us, not the voice of our authentic self.
Right. And the other piece of that is we need to be intimate with ourselves. And in order to do that, I have to know what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking and use the tools that I can find to find out what I'm thinking. If I can just sit with, I use that term a lot in my book, sit with. What I mean by that is just be conscious of what I'm really feeling. And that really does help me become more authentic. If I'm telling myself that I don't want to feel that, I'm going to run from that, I'm going to stay busy, I'm going to drink, I'm going to have sex, I'm going to do all kinds of things other than feel what I'm feeling, what I'm doing is running from my authentic self. But if I get in touch with my feelings and just sit with them, some of those feelings have a message for us. Anger, for example, has a message. Anger is one of the ways we love ourselves. Now, of course, we can misuse anger. We can hurt people with anger. We can say violent words. We can use violent actions. We can do all kinds of things with anger that misuse it. But if we're going to sit with anger, it can say, I am here, I am real, and I matter. Because if you think about anger, what generally makes us angry, generally speaking, okay, not specifically, but generally speaking, what makes us angry is you've stepped on my toes in some kind of way. You've disrespected me in some kind of way. You have harmed me in some kind of way. And when I say I'm angry about that, what I'm saying is I matter. Don't you see that I matter? I'm real. I'm a real person. I'm not an object. Don't you see that? That's what we're saying to other people and to ourselves with anger. So that's just one example of the way that our feelings can give us a message. Whereas if we just ignore that, if I say to myself, well, I can't feel anger because I'm a good person and anger is a bad feeling. If I say that to myself, then I'm probably missing out on creating the boundaries that I need to take care of myself. And that's why sometimes people with a good guy identity get in abusive relationships.
Yeah, I think that is such a big thing. And that's why we need to understand whether we're driven by the voice of guilt or the voice of our authentic self. And that's exactly what we've covered, you know, so far in the podcast. So I think now is the perfect time to actually be a bit more practical with today's topic, because, you know, I think it's a lot of theory there. And I think you sort of shared a few things we can try. But for our audience who's new to this and who's kind of wondering, what is my authentic self really? And, you know, what's guilt in this context? I still don't really know. I want to work on it, but I don't know how and where to start. What is a practice you would recommend to them so that they can start perhaps to manage the guilt and to, you know, slowly tone it down, or, you know, try to not have as, or maybe I'll use your word for this, try to be driven by the voice of authentic self rather than the voice of guilt in their lives.
Right. Yeah, first I want to define guilt a little bit. This is not like a clinical term by any means at all, but guilt is the voice that says you should do this or you should do that. And it will tell you that you should never do anything for yourself, particularly with regard to the good guy identity. You should never do anything for yourself. You should always be doing for other people. Guilt is that voice, and the authentic self, like I said a little while ago, is going to tell you more about what you desire. What we don't understand about the human heart is that compassion is a genuine emotion that is a form of desire. What we think is that if I'm living out a desire, I'm just going to turn into this selfish person who doesn't care about other people. But I don't want to live out of desire. I want to live out of the shoulds, but actually compassion is a desire. So I can care about you and do something for you motivated totally by desire, by compassion. And if we think that way, if we understand that about the human heart, then compassion can become a practice, just like living from desire can become a practice. So instead of thinking about other people as people I need to serve and take care of and sacrifice for, we can think about, where do I feel compassion, and go in that direction. So if I think I need to be serving other people, I might think, well, I have to serve everybody. Everybody that comes into my life, I need to serve them. You know, I've had people come to me and say, you know, the people in my office don't do anything and I'm loaded down with all the work they don't do. Well, how did that happen? Well, that happened, generally speaking, again, not specifically, but generally speaking, it happened because I'm doing so much for people in the office they expected of me. They've come to expect it of me, so they don't have anything left to do because I'm doing it all, right? So I've served those people because I think I should serve everybody. Whereas compassion might say, there's a certain population that I really, really care about, and I want to serve those people. And what happens when we do that out of compassion is we get happier. We get happier because we're honoring our own hearts that say, I feel compassion about these particular people, and I'm going to serve those people. Now, that doesn't mean we don't care about anything else or anyone else. It just means that I'm following my heart. So the first practice to implement is to try to get in touch with your heart. And that means sitting with your emotions. When you feel an emotion, try not to send it away. I talk to people about journaling a lot because that helps us to, you know, write down that emotion and then sit with it a little while and just see what it will gestate. You know, you talked about pauses in our careers and pauses a little while ago about, you didn't use the word pause, but I think of it as a pause that we might not be doing something. If I'm an achiever, I might have a period where I'm not doing something and I feel guilty about that. Well, that also not only can be a way of sort of waiting to see what will be the next thing, but I call it a period of gestation, like a pregnancy. You know, I'm going to birth something new out of that. And when we sit with an emotion, it's kind of like that. It's I'm pausing to just see what that emotion has got to tell me. And sitting with doesn't mean I'm going to sit down and, you know, examine my belly button for the next year. It just means that I'm going to pay attention to that feeling enough to know what it's trying to tell me. It might be telling me I need boundaries. It might be telling me I need a new career. It might be telling me that I'm really happy with where I am and I just didn't notice that. It, you know, it might be telling me all kinds of things, but if I'm not paying attention to it, it's not telling me anything. So sitting with our emotions, journaling is a way to do that. Another thing we can do is meditate. I believe strongly in meditation because what it does, and I'm not talking about sitting in any one position or holding your hands in any one position or, you know, saying any particular chant or anything like that. I'm talking about a time of every day when you just sit. I'm just sitting alone and letting your mind do what it does and just not trying to grab hold of anything and identify with it. So I'm saying, I'm just going to let happen what happens in me, and I'm just going to do that for 10 minutes every day and see what comes up. And maybe it'll be some garbage that I want to throw away. And maybe it'll be something really significant. But sometimes just sitting brings us wisdom. So I really encourage people to meditate. And again, that practice that I told you a little while ago about trying to take 2 or 3 hours of a day when you have time to do it and try to do nothing but what you desire to do. Try to get in touch with that desire and experiment with it a little bit to say, well, I'd like to take a walk. Well, yeah, this wasn't it. I didn't really want to do this. Or, let's take a walk. And yeah, this is fun. I think I want to keep doing this. To experiment, not to think you have to have some definition of desire that's written in stone, but to actually experiment with it and find out what works, what's true, and what's not. And I also encourage people to, over time, and I don't know how long, but over time, make a list of at least 10 things that are self-soothing. And by soothing, I mean it calms you down, makes you feel a sense of peace. It makes you feel like you've been loved on a little bit by yourself, maybe. And that could be taking that walk, listening to that music, dancing, getting into some kind of rhythm that you just sort of rock with. It can mean calling a friend when you're down. It could mean going out with friends to hang out and just laugh about stuff. It can mean watching funny movies on TV to make yourself laugh. It can be all kinds of things. I don't know what it is for any one individual. It's very different for each individual. But if you take time to just kind of build that list over time, stick it on your refrigerator or your wall or something so that when one of those things doesn't work to soothe you, something else will. And it'll be experimental. Again, like the desire, it'll be experimental. So all of those activities help us get more in touch with what's going on inside of us so that we're not so much focused on the outside and what other people need. We're focusing on the inside to find out what we need, and then we can serve others from that authenticity.
Those are a lot of different practices there. And, you know, while we asked for one, you shared many, and I love all of them, especially the 10 self-soothing things there. I think that that's amazing to be reminded of. I think someone told me about that a while ago, and I was kind of like, oh, that's cool, but I actually never got down to doing that. So, you know, now I've got another reminder. I have to make that list. Gotta do that straight after this, I don't forget. But yeah, I think that's a really good thing to do. And it's true, you know, each person is unique. And so to get in touch with our authentic self, we need to understand ourselves. First of all, you know, if you ask me to list it right now, I have to think a little bit. And gotta see how I normally spend my time. You know, it's just such a big thing. Sometimes we don't even understand ourselves, which is both funny and sad. And I think, you know, when we know why it's so important, especially through today's conversation, hopefully our audience will try at least one of these practices. And I think journaling, meditation, they're definitely great practices, and I can attest to that. I love journaling, I love meditating, and they really help me improve my quality of life in general, not just for my happiness, but in other aspects as well. And so thank you for sharing those once again. Before we close, we have open mic, as I mentioned earlier. You know, we've talked a lot about guilt today, but it's been fascinating to look at it from the perspective of, you know, the voices of guilt versus the voices of the authentic self, which I really enjoy. But I also know that your work has so much more to offer, and you're passionate about so many different things. So to close it out, please feel free to talk about anything else that you're passionate about that you might not get to mention yet, or maybe even more on this topic.
Well, I will tell you a little bit about just my with regard to creativity in my life. That's another thing that I think can be very, very useful in finding our authentic selves, is what is it do I want to create? And for me, I'm a musician, I'm an artist, I'm an author. And I had to figure out which one of those. I had somebody come to me one time and say, you know, Andrea, you're a dilettante. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And he was saying, you focus on your art, and you focus on your music, and you focus on your poetry, and you focus on your writing of nonfiction. And he said, you can't do all of those and have any, you know, real success at any one of them. And he said, you need to choose one. And so I still paint sometimes, and I still do my music sometimes, and I still write poetry sometimes, and I still but I have chosen to do my nonfiction and to write those books. And when I chose that is when I started publishing books. So I think, again, figuring out what really works for you as an individual. You know, I sold a few paintings. I had one song published. I thought, well, one day I'm going to get to do it all. And, you know, that doesn't work. So figuring out what is the most thing that you're most passionate about. And for me, it's not just what I'm most passionate about, but what I'm most compassionate about as well. The things that I've written about are the things that move me for other people. And so I write about those things as well. So yeah, and my blog works to help me do that once a month. I don't write in the blog every day, but once a month I write a blog, and those are always things that are meaningful to me, and that I can give from my compassion to other people as well. And the same is with the Authentic Living Show. That show is a way of reaching out to other people and offering, you know, some really great interviews that I've had with other people that are what I call life changers, very influential people that I've been able to interview on that show that offer a great deal of information. And recently I've been sort of taking a sabbatical from the show because I've been writing, And so there's a lot of repeats on the show, but I've been working on the show since 2008, however many years that is. And so, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff to draw from. So I've just been doing repeats of those. So, but that works as well because they're all something that gives not only to me, but to other people as well. So those are kind of the things that I'm passionate about.
That's a really great
about.
Reminder to all of us, you know, in terms of our creativity, right? It's another aspect of our authentic self that sometimes we forget about because a lot of adults are kind of saying, I'm not that creative. I truly believe we are all creative in our own ways, in our own right. And I think that's such a great thing that you're sharing. And yeah, you're saying 2008, you know, that's 15 years of work. You know, so I'm sure it has been really enriching in a lot of ways. So if our audience would like to find out more about, you know, those enriching things that you have created and, you know, find out more about your work, where should they go?
Well, you can just put Authentic Living into Google and it should come up, our Authentic Living Show, and it should come up. In terms of my website, it's andreamatthews.com. And Matthews is spelled with one T and Andrea is A-N-D-R-E-A.
So, Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I love the concept of authentic living and especially learning about, you know, the angle of guilt today has been really eye-opening for me personally. And I hope it has been the same way for our audience.
You have been listening to Sarah Boost, the Happiness Science Insights podcast produced by the Happiness Science Labs, a division of LMSL, the Life Management Science Labs. More episodes are available from 10 Life Management Perspectives and can be found by searching LMSL on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and other podcasting apps available on your devices. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, share, and subscribe to our channel so that other people can find it and we can continue to provide quality content. More of our work can be found on our website, ha.lmsl.net, where you can join our movement. I'm Lu Ngo. Thanks for tuning in.